So our first speaker this morning is Judith Zinsser. She's a professor in the history department at Miami University in Ohio. She is the author of the definitive biography on Du Châtelet, Amélie Du Châtelet, Daring Genius of the Enlightenment. We have some flyers available out on the table in the entryway if you're interested in picking one up. She is also author of A History of Their Own, Women in Europe from Prehistory to the Present. It's a two-volume, I expect, with that sort of scope. And she has also done some work on translating and editing some collected works of Amélie du Châtelet, which just came out in 2009, I believe. So she'll be speaking to us today on the topic of the evolution of Amélie du Châtelet's way of thinking from the métaphysique de mort to the métaphysique du tube. Please join me in welcoming Professor Zinsser.
Okay, you'll see in the handout, has various parts, of course. The very last page is the list of Du Châtelet's principal works, and I wanted to start with that because the blue are the ones that were actually published. Because the purpose of my talk is to show that you can make connections between all of these disparate writings. As you may or may not realize, scholars in a variety of disciplines have taken pieces of her works or pieces of her total works and concentrated on them. For instance, French literary scholars spend a great deal of time on the Mandeville and also on the Discourse on Happiness. As you know, philosophers are entranced by the Institution, the foundations of physics, with good reason, but there are also, mathematicians and physicists are excited by her commentary on Newton's Principia and also her translation. So, in fact, there are at least six or seven different discrete disciplines that have concerned themselves with her writings at various times. Well, as a historian, and not only that, but as what Isaiah Berlin called a hedgehog, someone who likes to think about big things, my goal has always been to try and explain her life, number one, and then, as happens with historians, what I wanted to show you today is that I believe I have worked out the audacity of the scholar, how her mind worked. In other words, how she made connections, how you can get from an effort to translate and comment and adapt for a French audience, Mandeville's Fable of the Bees, the remarks from it, all the way to a translation of Newton's Principia and the Discourse on Happiness, which are her last two works, in which I'll talk about when we get to them. In any case, that's my goal, is to show the connections between all of these and to suggest that she did have a métaphysique du tout, a way of thinking about everything that evolved in the course of her life and her reading and her writings. So the quotations, I thought a long time about this and finally decided that the thing to do was to give you the French but also the English translation. I'm used to kind of doing a thing with a microphone and dancing around, and because that's much more fun, like a Madonna or something. Anyway, so I decided that I would give you the English as well. I'm convinced that many women are either ignorant of their talents because of the flaws in their education, or bury them.
Let's go get you a microphone.
So I'm fine. No, I'll do that another time. I'll do my Madonna gig another time. I'm convinced that many women are either ignorant of their talents because of the flaws in their education or bury them out of prejudice and for lack of a bold spirit. Faute de courage dans l'esprit, which for me is one of the sort of mantras of Madame du Châtelet for all of us. In any case, this realization came to her after she did have some education with her brother. That's how she knew Latin and Euclidean geometry and perhaps some Italian and some English. But that's really it. She read widely in literature as an adolescent. We have little cahiers where she quoted out passages and things like that. But she very quickly, after that, when he was sent off to the college, to the sort of secondary school, had a life of frivolity. And this was her marriage. She produced three children. This was expected of her. She did not balk at this. This was not some kind of feminist rebellion or anything. She was happy. The marriage was one of court connections and ancient lineage. Everyone was very happy with it. Her duty, but Paris was frivolity, and she uses the word frivolity. And it was only later that she realized that what she wanted to do was to read. And this is in roughly 1734, when she returns to Paris and starts taking mathematics lessons. And I see her as having had three personas, successive personas that evolved. First, as a géomètre, mathematics. This was definitely the way in which she saw that you could model the universe with mathematical equations. And the excitement of that for her was quite dramatic. Next, there was the physicienne, the physicist, who would make observations, experiment. She read Locke. This was the first book that she really became engaged with in 1733-34. And the two, mathematics and physics, could give her a sense of the intelligibility of the natural world. But then there was the problem that observation and experiment could be subjective, and that this would make it less certain. And certitude is a word that she uses often in her writing. She's seeking science in the Aristotelian sense of knowledge that was certain, certain knowledge. So this is where the philosophe came in, a methodology, a way of thinking about knowledge that she could hold on to. Now, I need to tell you right now that there are two gatherings I've been at, which I put up there, at Notre Dame and in Hanover, both of which helped me to think in a way that is does not come naturally to me as a historian, but to try and think philosophically and to understand the kinds of questions that philosophers ask and the ways in which they answer them. So, in particular, Catherine Brading and Ruth Hagengruber have been incredible help to me. So, the first persona is the geometer, okay, le géomètre, the mathematician. And she made a statement about this, and some of you have heard me talk about this portrait before. I think the portraits tell us many things. Normally, this kind of portrait of a young woman, she would be holding a prayer book. But Du Châtelet is not, and it's hard to see in this reproduction, but that paper that she's showing has geometric drawings on it. So right away, she identified herself, even as a young woman, as someone who was quite different. Now, geometry becomes her great love. As she said, geometry is the key to all discoveries, and if there are still inexplicable things in physics, that is because geometry has been insufficiently used to explain them, and one has perhaps not yet gone far enough in this science. Now, geometry, of course, géomètre at the time meant mathematics more generally, not just Euclidean geometry. So the next persona is certainly as the physicienne. This is the famous portrait that's often reproduced of her, in theory, working on her translation of Newton's Principia. Notice that the compass that she's holding is down, indicating it's a trope from the Renaissance, and it's indicating that she is mathematically gifted, or that she is presenting this in the spirit of mathematics. So what's unusual about her as a physicist or physicienne in the 18th century is that she decides to write and publish on her own. Now, there are a whole bunch of manuscripts that have become available recently, and scholars are already beginning to work on one of them. This is from a preface from these new papers in which she explains that she will show the path by which truth penetrated my soul, the order in which my ideas came to be organized. So part of the reason then that she writes is this desire to help others understand what she's doing and how she thinks. But also in these new manuscripts, there is what all the feminist historians get excited about, the fourth reference to women. And it's encouraging, again, to some extent explains why she might want to write. One writes ordinarily for the use to others and for glory. Me, I write for my own instruction and for the glory of my sex and for that of Mr. Newton. So we have then her idea to her commitment to continue to study and to write. And this led her to reading memoirs of the Academy of Sciences, the royal transactions, the acta editorum, the editatorum of the German universities and German scholars, and it was here that she became fascinated with a controversy. Now, the interesting thing is that this controversy, everyone thought had been settled. In England, they thought it had been settled one way, and on the continent, they thought it had been settled another way. So the problem with force and force vives, there's Newton and the position of the Académie des Sciences. Okay, those of you who think that the French didn't like Newton are wrong, because there are many ways in which they adored Newton. Okay, so this is one of them, and it's the definition of force that was dramatized, the argument was dramatized beautifully last night, I thought, in the play. Now, Leibniz and Johann Bernoulli, a Swiss mathematician, believed in an alternative equation. Now, as we all know, both are true. It's just different ways of thinking about motion and matter. In any case, at that time, it was a very serious argument. Now, this argument in physics led quite dramatically to her understanding that she was going to have to think about metaphysics. And there is a particular letter to Maupertuis that's often quoted and that I have up there, but the only thing that puzzles me at present is liberty. For in the end, I believe myself free, and I do not know if this quantity of force, which is always the same in the universe, in other words, the Newtonian explanation, the Leibnizian explanation, does not destroy liberty. Initiating motion, is that not to produce in nature a force that did not exist? Now, if we have not the power to begin motion, we are not free. So for her, and the person who has explained this so clearly and beautifully, these connections, this is just stolen flat out from Catherine Brady, that the mechanics of matter, okay, science demonstrable by mathematics and experiment, then you can say, okay, everything else is metaphysical. However, comma, mechanics of matter presupposes that you know what matter is and the role of force in determining all its attributes, including motion. And those, ladies and gentlemen, as Madame du Châtelet realized, are metaphysical questions, metaphysical presuppositions. So she is now presented with a problem that she wants to resolve. In theory, Bernoulli had always assumed, he wrote the memoir in 1728 that was supposed to settle it all. He was an advocate of F equals mv squared. Academy did not accept it. Dortus de Mara wrote the Academy answer. And the presumption was that this answer was definitive, that no one would argue anymore, and no one did, because when she brings it up again, we're talking about 1738, 39, 40. So she is essentially reviving a dispute that everyone kind of assumed settled one way on the continent and one way in England in particular. So the irony is that she brings it up when Bernoulli thought that her tutor, Maupertuis, who was one of his students, would do it, would take care of it. So she then, here's a piece of paper, so they're just going to be flying around here, don't worry about it. That's why I can't do my Madonna act, because I've got all these pieces of paper. So we then go to the key choice that she had to make. And this is number 6 on your handout. The obscurities in which some parts of metaphysics are still shrouded serve as pretext for the laziness of the majority of men not to study it. I point out to you that that is the solution that they come to at the end of the 18th century, which is to not try to work all that out and just to continue to focus on what there is that we can know. They persuade themselves that because not everything is known, nothing can be. Yet there are certainly points of metaphysics susceptible to demonstrations as rigorous as geometric demonstrations. So Emily is the one who is going to do what Simon Schaffer calls take the path not taken. She is going to continue to try and sort out these metaphysical quandaries. So this is her third persona, the philosophe, and this is one of my favorite portraits of her. It's the official portrait that she had copied and sent to everybody and was had engravings made and whatever, because you did that. Instead of doing Facebook, you sent around your portrait. You will notice that there's all kinds of wonderful symbols in it, but the notice that the compass is pointing in both, in other words, it's pointing this way, indicating not only mathematics, but also philosophy. So, her goal, as she explains in the preface to the institutions, her hope, she says, this is number 7, we lack a system of calculation for metaphysics similar to that which has been found for mathematics, by means of which, with the aid of certain givens, one arrives at knowledge of unknowns. Perhaps some genius will one day find this system. Several truths of physics, metaphysics, and geometry are obviously interconnected. Now, she was not the first person to hope to find this mathematics, so to speak. It certainly was a goal of Leibniz's. It certainly was a goal of Maupertuis at different points in his life. This is not an unusual goal, but the interesting thing is she would never call herself a genius, but she does present then, in the end, some kind of system, although calculation is not perhaps exactly the right word for it. Then, this is another version of the same kind of comment. This is number 8. Thus, the union of the mechanics of bodies that we see results from the metaphysical union of their elements. For in the end, all the mechanics that we sense derives and flows from the first source, from higher principles of metaphysics. So the result in the Institution, as you know, is her very original synthesis, her explanation of how to get from matter to metaphysics, although she starts with metaphysics and goes to matter. And as you all know, she owes a debt to many thinkers who came before, which is why to describe it as a synthesis is not meant to diminish her accomplishment, but rather to suggest that she herself was aware that she was using ideas, picking and choosing ideas from many different sources. So, as she said, as you all know, I believe, most of you anyway, and have studied in much greater depth than I, it is to Leibniz that she looks for the initial method, the underlying way of reasoning. How do we know what we know? And the handout has the foundations of physics, the chapters of the foundations of physics, and I think other people are probably going to use that too, so I thought it was worth reproducing. But I wanted to emphasize that it is Leibniz's different three rules. She takes the three key rules of reasoning, and sufficient reason, the concept of sufficient reason, is certainly the most significant throughout the Institution. And this is her version of it. You will see her version of the effort to explain how significant it was. You will soon see this principle is the only thread that could guide us in these labyrinths of error that the human mind has built for itself in order to have the pleasure of going astray. So these are the chapters. It's the last page of your handout. And I think what I would like to point out for the purposes of my thesis, or my hypothesis, I guess I should say, is that, as I said, she moves from metaphysical questions to mathematical, mechanical questions. How do we know what we know? These are the principles of our knowledge, the chapter 1. How can we have any certitude about our knowledge? Well, we need these rules of reasoning. God becomes the eternal, the géomètre, the creator, who does not need to intervene after creating all of these, creating the cosmos and also the natural laws that govern it. The significance of hypothesis in terms of going on and thinking about the rest of the universe. The context and nature of matter, then, is her, and finally, Newtonian mechanics. And notice that it's not clear on the handout, but that it is chapter 21 where she devotes all of chapter 21 to the question of force and force vives and her argument with Dorcas de Mauro. And I've essentially presented to you her reasoning from mechanics to metaphysics, but she presents it to us as metaphysics to mechanics. So I believe that at this point, she has created what I think is her unified method of thought. I mentioned Descartes and Newton in particular, but others will know the debts to Leibniz and to Locke. I do believe, and this is sort of this is my big hypothesis here, this is the one, that she can reason and perceive right, as a human being. She can formulate trustworthy hypotheses, determine the needed experiments or experiences or mathematical models to test the hypothesis. She can deduce or observe probable consequences that she can make reasoned analyses from her observations. And thus she can arrive at certitude, at truth, at causes. This is the frontispiece to the first edition of the of her Institution, her Foundations of Physics, and it's a particularly telling one, particularly for my thesis, in that she is, that is Du Châtelet. When I showed it classes at first, they thought it was a man, but I said, no, that's Emily Du Châtelet, that's her. She often wore a very loose sort of gown when she worked, and did not, she had her hair often just kind of held back, and she lived in a world in which gray hair, you know, I don't have to powder my hair, she would have initially. And there she is, she's going up through the clouds, which I presume are the clouds of ignorance, to a temple, which is truth enshrined, and there at the top are her three key mentors or influences. We have Descartes, Leibniz, and Newton. Now, many people, and I could give a whole talk on why I think this is what would have gone in volume two, but I'm not going to, but everyone is invited to speculate about the bits and pieces that we have of what, because as you know, it says volume one right on the cover, right on the front of the first page, that there was a volume two. Now, some of it some of these notes and things were used in other writings, and certainly the description of the planetary world that is mentioned in one of the documents is what became the basis of part of her commentary on the Principia. So now we have one piece of the argument about Force Vives that was left. And it also, from my perspective, is the most useful because it helps to explain the one book that doesn't really fit, okay? It doesn't really fit anything, and that's this Examen de la Bible. We haven't explained why she would devote probably 2 years, although we don't really know, to writing what is an endless critique of the Bible. She does it chapter and verse. Okay? A definitive edition has been made by Bertram Schwarzbach in France, and it's out, and it came out in 2011 or 12, I'm not sure, I can't remember which. And it is fascinating. So, why would she do that? Now, it has to do with the Force Vives controversy, is what I am hypothesizing. First of all, we have the Newtonian idea about force that involves divine intervention and replenishment. But if you do that, then what's a natural law? It's just something that can be changed at will by God. Or you can go with the other definition, the conservation of force, but that interferes with freedom of movement. So, she focuses on the first part, which is the nature of God, the nature and role of God in the universe. And the Examen de la Bible is an example of what was, at the time, a very popular way of writing a scientific text, where you used rhetorical arguments when the experiment, because that's the problem with this God question, is that experiments don't, and mathematics can't give you any kind of definitive answer about the nature and role of God. So she uses what she learned in particular from Maupertuis, whose Figure des Astres, I don't know whether any of you are familiar with that anyway, what you do is you prove that the other explanation is so stupid. You present both, but you present one in such a way that it's obvious that the other must be true. So in this case, she cannot accept option one, and so the idea that God, this idea of divine intervention and replenishment, she can't deny the immutability of natural laws, so she's going to instead prove that that is absolutely ridiculous. So her hypothesis, in a sense, so the God of the Old Testament, she has to deal with him, she has to deal with Jesus. So testing the hypothesis, is the way in which she's basically proceeding. I should mention there are a lot of other scientists, natural philosophers of the era, who used this method, this rhetorical approach to scientific arguments. Boerhaave does it. She had to learn it when she wrote her dissertation on the nature of fire. She kind of had to acquire the language and the way you speak about things. So their probability increases to such a point that one can presume them to be a certainty. So that's what she's going to do. So the Old Testament is, in fact, the funniest because she really has a nasty, sarcastic sense. And there's no question that parts of it were written by Voltaire because they started working on this commentary on the Bible very early on in their time at Siri using something by a long, long exegesis by a man named Dom Calme. It's like 24 volumes. And so that my this is about Adam and Eve. After she describes in Genesis the beginnings, so far God had behaved like a strange king who wanted to test the obedience of his subjects on ridiculous things and who punished them afterwards well beyond their crimes, Adam and Eve and all mankind. From that moment, God resolved to make a glorious deed and to send his only son in order to free us. But having formed this design, he keeps it to himself for 4,000 years, repents having created man, and to console himself, he resolved to drown him. So she also, as she goes through the prophets, and she gets really bored doing the prophets, she calls them the prophet du jour, the prophet of the day, by the time she gets to the end where there are these, you know, what we would think of now as minor prophets. And she says it's ridiculous. These prophecies could mean anything. And this is something that other commentators had said, and so there is a great deal of biblical exegesis to interpret the prophecies to mean that Jesus is, that there will be a Messiah. Also wonderful, she talks about the flood. She says no one could have ever gone back and lived there because the all of the fumes and everything from the decaying vegetation would have killed everybody. She says a whale can't swallow a person. I mean, it's really delightful. Anyway, so then she goes on to the New Testament. And here she based her arguments on a book that we know she translated, that's in St. Petersburg, her translation. It isn't a literal translation, it's like Precy translation of it. A book by an Englishman, Thomas Woolston, and it's here that what she does is she disproves, I'm sure she felt she disproved, the divinity of Jesus by showing that all the miracles are just sleight of hand, fraud, whatever. Lazarus was a friend of Jesus's, and it was a setup, for example. That's one of my favorites. But the key for her is the resurrection. And from Matthew, she says, this chapter, this is number 11, tells the story of the resurrection of Jesus. It is certain, according to the four evangelists, that Jesus was only one day and two nights in the tomb, and yet he had said very precisely that he would be there 3 days and three nights. Now, I had never noticed that before. I don't know about you, but I had never noticed that before. Well, she did. And her explanation is that the apostles were scared that he wouldn't be resurrected. And so they made up the whole thing. He was dead, whatever, and they made up the whole thing. Now, it could have been very awkward if he actually had been resurrected, I guess. I mean, I don't even know why she doesn't go into that. In any case, this is her final proof, in a sense, that you don't have to pay any attention to this God who replenishes things and whatever, this God of the Old and New Testament. The natural world functions on its own from the natural laws and the original creation by God, the geomat. So I think that what I'd like to say is that, in a sense, she has now arrived at her metaphysique du tout, her metaphysics of everything. And this is the frontispiece to the second edition of the Institution, and if anybody looks certain, she looks certain. I feel that she arrived at certitude. Well, I kind of cheated because I still haven't explained all of her writings, okay? We still have the discourse on happiness. And I believe that what happened is that whether she realized it or not, okay, because I have no actual proof of this except my own reasoning, always dangerous, that she was able to apply those rules of reasoning and this concept of natural laws to human behavior. This is how you deal with what is free will. Okay? And I see her using the concept of force vives in a sense to think about people. that force is inherent. For the word force, I would substitute passions. Matter and motion, of course, is the person. And that motion, the motion or the passage of a person through life can be measured by the obstacles overcome, which is part of the definition of force vivis, and not just by the distance and the time traveled. So I believe, as I say, that she was able to apply this. So then what happens to free will? Well, this is an early version of her, the first version that we have of her definition of free will. And this is number 12. I call liberty the power to think of one thing or not to think of it, to move or not to move in conformity with the nature of one's esprit. Now, later, of course, she thinks about it in much more detail. And if you look at number 13, number 13, my essence is one's esprit. It's basically the same, although now she's essence has become the word that she would use, makes possible all the movements that I can make with my arms, but the actuality of such a movement depends on and is determined in part by exterior objects because of the previous situation of my arms. And she makes a distinction, as many of you know, in her discussion of God between the idea and the actualization of it, bringing it, having it come to fruition. So there's certainly, that's natural laws of motion. That's the way she deals with them. So I can do it all, but it depends on whether I hit the microphone or whether I drop my watch or all of these other kinds of external things. So then we have, there are other obstacles that she mentions at different times in her writings. Certainly her own sex, including the humors of the body. She felt that she was very hot in the sense, the Aristotelian sense of the four humors, and that therefore she had to drink a lot of water when she woke up in the morning. Your état, your place in society, she certainly felt that was significant for her. The customs and laws of the country, these she talks about in Mandeville. The upbringing for girls and boys, gendered behavior, that's in the Mandeville. And then the education or lack of education. So the discourse sur le bonheur, this discourse on happiness, offers guidance for one's behavior and one's happiness. And I put this together because it is the most misrepresented of her writings. And I say misrepresented, not for a variety of reasons, which we could talk about at length. But in any case, this is what the message is of the whole little pamphlet. Use your reason to achieve moderation, to satisfy your tastes. And tastes can become passions. Still use your reason. You can make passions work for your happiness and not your unhappiness. And there are a variety of ways in which she talks about this in the discourse. But that's how we get to the Métaphysique d'amour, which is the first part of it. And I put it first because it's a phrase that she uses in a letter to a friend in the spring of 1735, when she's trying to decide whether or not to join Voltaire at Ciré. And they made it, the play kind of used a little dramatic license on all of that. She was reluctant to go, partly because it would create a scandal, not because she was having an affair, but because Voltaire was bourgeois and was also considered to be kind of out of bounds because he was always in the Bastille and this and that, all despite the fact that he was considered France's greatest playwright at the time, its greatest poet. But there were these sort of two pieces of Voltaire, and those were the ones that members of her family, in particular the mother's side of her family, really disapproved of and made difficulties for her, not her husband, who always remained, as portrayed in the play, very loyal to her. And anyway, so we go on to number 14 and the ways in which I think she dealt with this. She had a hypothesis, okay? And the hypothesis, this is, thus in making hypothesis, one must deduce all the consequences, and that can legitimately be deduced, and next compare them with experiment. And experiment in French is the same as the word for experience, so, which is neat, okay? Experience is experiment and just our word for experience. Confirmed by experiments, the probability would be greatest. But if there is a single one contrary to them, either the entire hypothesis must be rejected, if this consequence follows from the entire hypothesis, or that part of the hypothesis from which it necessarily follows. So, the last section of the essay, the source, the discourse on happiness, is the one where she speaks in this way. It's the part that she wrote specifically for the man she was in love with at the time, Saint-Lambert. And, I mean, truly, it was a gift. She gave it as a gift to him after she'd finished writing it. The hypothesis, shall I fall in love again or not fall in love again? Okay? Love is the greatest source of happiness. She's already told us that. Well, her experience or experiment, she was very happy with Voltaire and very unhappy when he betrayed her with his niece. In fact, as portrayed in the play, she felt that it broke her heart and whatever, and that it was, as she explains in the second part of the previous part of the Discourse on Happiness, it was study that had given her a sense of how to have a life where she was not dependent on anybody else and she could move forward. Well, the consequences, if she gives in to this passion that she's beginning to feel, this sixth sense that she has about Saint-Lambert, she could be very happy, but also risk being very unhappy. So, she thinks about it in the sense of, I believe, these various wonderful rules of reasoning. Okay, by the law of indiscernibles, Saint-Lambert is not Voltaire. So therefore, the whole hypothesis, okay, is not necessarily at fault, but merely that example of it. So, her conclusion, so it would be ridiculous to refuse oneself this pleasure for fear of an unhappiness that perhaps will only be experienced after having known great happiness. So, in conclusion, a unified method of thought to discover truth that you can apply not only to the natural world, to metaphysics, but also to human behavior. And this is probably one of the last representations of Du Châtelet, and it's my favorite. So I thought I would end with that. Thank you very much.